This is a recording for Dave Johnson with Institute for America's Future on August 21st, 2013 at 1 p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have all speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as procedure to follow if you'd like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you all for joining this call today. I'm Dave Johnson. I'm Senior Fellow with Campaign for America's Future. You can find us online at ourfuture.org. On today's call, we're talking about the revival of manufacturing. This is especially timely because of the bankruptcy of Detroit, a city that used to exemplify America's manufacturing prosperity, now a wasteland of crumbling buildings and homes and people. Joining us will be Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing and Carl Pope, former executive director of the Sierra Club. After their comments, we will be open to questions and answers. But first, Campaign for America's Future does calls like this as a regular series discussing manufacturing and trade issues. You can join our low-traffic announcement listserv. Email me at djohnson@ourfuture.org. So let me set the stage for today's call. Detroit's bankruptcy shows exactly what this whole manufacturing discussion is really about. Manufacturing is one of the main ways a country makes a living. We have to have things to sell to others to bring in the money to buy things from others. America used to sell far more to the world than we brought in. Until the early 80s, we were the largest creditor nation. We made things and sold them. Then tax and trade policies transformed us to the world's largest debtor nation. We moved factories out of the country or just bought things from elsewhere. And since then, that imbalance has only gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. Do you remember the movie Roger and Me about what happened to Flint? That movie showed what happens to cities when government gets out of the way and lets factories and industries move. That movie was in 1989, and the same thing has only gotten worse and spread around the country. As the factories moved, well-paying manufacturing jobs disappeared and were replaced by jobs at places like Walmart and Staples. This started a downward spiral, and now everyone feels the downward pressure on wages. Entire regions were devastated as manufacturing left the country and suppliers left the country, and design jobs and machine maintenance jobs and all the rest of the jobs associated with manufacturing left the country, and over time the middle class started to shrink and feel the squeeze. And now we see the results in major cities like Detroit. So what are we going to do about it? As a country, we have to rethink this and remake America. And to talk about a new book called Remaking America, I would like to introduce Scott Paul. Scott is president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, a partnership of some of America's leading manufacturers and the United Steelworkers Union, working to restore American manufacturing competitiveness. Scott, welcome.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks for everybody for joining us on the call, and thanks to Carl, one of the authors of this book as well, who I'll be introducing in just a few moments. I thought David teased the conversation up nicely by talking about what we've seen in particular with the bankruptcy in Detroit and the underlying factors that made that possible. One thing that we thought would be timely to do was publish a serious book that looked at both the potential for growth and the potential pitfalls that face American manufacturing, because there's a couple things that are very clear right now. One is that there is now more than ever awareness of the importance of manufacturing to our economy and to strong communities, as Dave mentioned. There's definitely more of a movement than we've seen in a long time towards localization, and that includes products as a part of that. So not only food and farmers markets and locally sourced restaurants and and artisans, but also to some extent production. And then you have some macroeconomic factors that may help to make American manufacturing more competitive over the coming couple of decades. That includes some demographic factors, the fact that the workforce in China in particular will be shrinking as a percentage of the size of its population, while ours will not be. That means wages will likely go up in China. You have an energy advantage in the United States, and we're finally starting to play some ball on renewables, although, as Carl will point out, we've missed some opportunities there. And so we have a potential energy advantage, and we've always been a country that has a natural resource advantage, a human resource advantage, and the largest consumer market in the world. And the fact that if we just consumed more that was made domestically rather than imported, that would go a long way towards some revival in manufacturing. And everybody from ABC News to some folks in popular culture, and then some serious takes done by folks at Harvard Business School, MIT, Brookings, some other places have all pointed towards this possibility of a new era for American manufacturing. Since this is an issue that kind of lacks a top line silver bullet solution, through the book we wanted to take an integrated approach at some of the particular issues, and so we assembled an all-star cast to take a look at some of these, including a couple of professors that look at technology and innovation, in particular this thing called 3D printing, which is fascinating, as well as the idea that publicly sponsored or that taxpayer-financed innovation has helped to drive manufacturing progress. Harold Meyerson, who I know is familiar to a lot of you, has written a chapter on how we can make sure that any gains from manufacturing are broadly shared, and also how we can draw on some of the positive examples of a high-wage country like Germany in keeping its manufacturing relevant and growing as part of the economy and as part of the policy debate. We have chapters by a former USTR official on the importance of trade instrument, on sort of the guy, Harry Moser, who is a former manufacturing executive who talks extensively about reshoring and how we can persuade some larger enterprises as well as small and mid-sized enterprises to reshore production to the United States. Leo Hendry, who was the former chairman of AT&T Broadband and advisor to the Edwards and the Obama campaigns, has written a chapter on the importance of capital formation and the role, both positive, although it's a small one, and negative, which is a large one, that Wall Street plays in manufacturing. The volume was edited by Richard McCormick, who is within the manufacturing community very well known, has written about it for 20 years, and has a bit of a cult following in the manufacturing community. I contribute a chapter on policy changes that we need to see, and Carl's chapter focuses in tremendous detail, and I think with a powerful impact, on the role that energy policy, particularly in transition to cleaner fuels, renewable sources, could have for domestic manufacturing. The message of the book overall is a hopeful one, which is this: there is a role for public policy in manufacturing, whether you call it industrial policy, manufacturing strategy, economic policy. There are different variants of it, but I think kind of the overall thesis of the book is that there's a positive role that public policy can play in manufacturing, and it's essential to take this holistic approach, to look at the workforce, to look at innovation, to look at energy policy, to look at our trade balance, and various issues like that, and that coupled with this kind of nascent movement that we see among consumers who have an interest in either sustainability or localization can potentially drive a lot of job growth. But it's by no means a guaranteed thing, and in fact, we'll continue to lose ground if we don't engage in these sorts of policies. And that's not to say that global competition is a zero-sum game, but there are certainly some lessons that can be learned from high road strategies that countries like Germany employ to have a significant amount of their economy in manufacturing and therefore much more stability in terms of public finances, the middle class, and probably less of an impact from recession. Right now, even though Germany has $48 an hour wages, he has very strong unions, has lots of collaboration between business, labor, and government. Germany has 23% of its economy in manufacturing. It has a trade surplus. It has a very tiny trade deficit with China. On the other hand, when you look at our economy, we have less than 12% of our economy in manufacturing right now. We have an extraordinarily large trade deficit with China in particular, and for some reason that I'll leave you to kind of dissect, the blame always falls on the workers for all of this, even though it's clear that is not the issue. In fact, the workers are very much a net positive for the United States, but it's our policy, it's Wall Street, it's lack of consistent government support that have made the health and growth of manufacturing really challenging in recent times. And just the last thing that I will note is the political relevance of all of this. You saw President Obama basically run a campaign built on Made in America two times, in 2008 against John McCain, and then last time in 2012. Yes, there were a lot of issues that went into the mix, but when you look at the analytics, almost a million ads were run in the last presidential election cycle on the issue of jobs. Republican National Committee and Romney ran a fair number of them, but Obama. It continues to be a top-of-mind issue for voters, and it will always have geopolitical significance because the outsized role that manufacturing plays in the economy in key states like Ohio and Michigan and North Carolina and Virginia, and the list goes on. And the other thing that we have found out is sort of the secret sauce of some of this is that the idea of Made in America and a proactive manufacturing policy among voters has very broad and very nonpartisan support. That is, there's many Republicans and independents that support this idea as Democrats. You may not see that reflected in Washington, D.C., or in the media necessarily, but among voters that's certainly the case. And while there are a few other issues that enjoy that kind of political symmetry, there are not many of them. And so we're at a critical point for all of this. Talk more about, in particular, the energy aspects of this, and to answer the question of why a lifelong environmentalist would be interested in industry, and talking about industry, it is my great honor to introduce you to Carl Pope. Carl, as you may know, for many years was the fabulously successful executive director of the Sierra Club. He has a consulting firm now, and he writes and blogs and makes frequent TV appearances on energy policy and on having a productive and sustainable economy. He partnered with Leo Girard, the president of the Steelworkers, to form something called the Blue-Green Alliance to show that manufacturing and renewable energy can go hand in hand. And Carl's written a fabulous chapter. I'll let him talk a bit about that, and also to answer the question that I posed, and then we'll look forward to engaging you. Carl?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and it's an honor to be here. And it was a pleasure to write a chapter in this fantastic book. With the other chapters, you can't have all the guests on any one media appearance, but I would really urge people to take a look at the other contributions there. I learned a lot by being part of this process. So why am I writing a book about manufacturing? I met with a CEO of one of the major sort of manufacturing companies to talk about all this stuff, and he basically sort of looked at me and said in a very nice way, what the hell are you doing here? And the answer is fairly simple. If you take seriously what we've learned about both climate change and resource depletion and sustainability, the challenge which faces the United States is between now and 2050, which is basically 37 years, we have to replace, modernize, redo, upgrade, or renovate everything we built in the first 200 years of this country's history. So in 37 years, we have to rebuild what we built in 200 years. We have to remake it. And we are not going to outsource that to Shanghai. If we are going to take every car, every vehicle, every building, every power plant, every hospital, every police station, every bridge, every highway, every tunnel, and modernize it and make it sustainable for the 21st century, we are going to have to build a manufacturing sector in the United States that is the scale we have never done before. We're going to need windows and doors and concrete and steel and switches and turbines and processors and things that we haven't invented yet. And we're going to need to make them here. So I'm focusing on manufacturing because manufacturing is actually the key to sustainability. The other key point that's emerged, I've done most of my learning here in the energy sector because that's obviously where we need to lead the transition to sustainability. And the U.S. energy sector is a dark window into a national disgrace, which is that our leadership in Washington, but not in the states, so this is not a partisan issue, this is kind of a geographic issue, has more or less consciously decided in the 90s and the first part of the 2000s to throw manufacturing under the bus. We didn't lose manufacturing, we threw it away. There are certain kinds of low-wage, low-skill manufacturing that did go to other countries because they probably didn't belong as an important part of the U.S. economy. So the kind of textile jobs that went to China and now Cambodia, those kinds of jobs probably should have gone to China and Cambodia. But if you look at what happens in Europe, even in textiles, there are high-skill, high-technology manufacturing jobs that are employing thousands of workers and supporting tens of thousands of small companies, small businesses in Europe with good working conditions and high wages. We don't have those in the United States because we've chosen not to. If you look at energy, we've actually been handed a second chance. The shale gas revolution has created a situation in which the raw material for manufacturing, which in many cases is heavily manufacturing, is now available in the United States for about $3 to $4 a million cubic feet. And our competitors in Europe have to pay the Russians $10 a cubic foot for the same energy. And our competitors in China and Japan have to pay Qatar $18 for LNG per million cubic feet. So we have an enormous, enormous economic benefit and edge at the moment for manufacturing. And as a result, in the last 2 years alone, energy-intensive American industries have announced scores of major new plant construction. These are big facilities that are going to be built to take advantage of the fact that the United States has a competitive edge in natural gas prices. The same thing is true in the transportation sector. we are beginning to see a major potential migration of long-distance truck travel in the United States from being powered with expensive imported diesel to being powered with cheap domestic natural gas. So we've got a huge opportunity here, and Washington is actually literally throwing it away. Because what has happened is the Europeans and the Japanese have decided that they would like to take advantage of our cheap natural gas, and the free trade mantra, which dominates Washington almost to the exclusion of any other conversation, has caused the Obama administration thus far to approve 3 new natural gas export facilities, which by themselves are capable of shipping 16% of America's natural gas to Europe and Asia, which by itself could actually eliminate a significant part of the current U.S. price advantage in natural gas. Now, this is not how other fossil fuel producing countries do it. They make sure that their own domestic industries get first call on domestic oil and gas. Only in the United States do we actually allow contracts to be signed, and the contracts that are being signed commit for 20 years. They give foreign customers first call on American natural gas supplies. And in effect, that gives foreign markets, including OPEC, the ability to set and control the price of natural gas here in the United States. It's simply crazy. And we're doing this just so you understand how ill-prepared Washington is. The Department of Energy, when it reviews a proposal to export LNG from the United States, is required by the Natural Gas Act to make a finding that the exports are in the national interest. The process they go through uses a set of guidelines which were developed about 15 years ago by the Department of Energy to review proposals to import LNG to the United States. So we actually evaluate plans to export U.S. LNG using documents and guidelines which were written to evaluate importing LNG. Well, whatever you think about exports and imports of LNG, they're not the same thing. They do not have the same impact on the U.S. economy. They have opposite impacts on the U.S. economy. And it is clinically insane to use import guidelines to evaluate exports. But that is where Washington is. And the threat this poses, to give you a couple of examples, there is a Alcoa aluminum refinery in Freeport, Texas, which for the past 10 years has teetered on the edge of profitability. It has always been on Alcoa's list of aluminum facilities globally that it might shut down next if demand fell. For the past 3 years, the Freeport refinery has been one of the 3 most cost-effective aluminum refineries in the world because of low-cost U.S. natural gas. And if Washington continues to approve LNG export applications which are designed to close the gap between U.S. energy prices and European and Asian energy prices, that Freeport refinery will lose the economic edge it currently has, and it will be back on the list of facilities that might shut down. So I think we have a remarkable opportunity in the United States in the energy sector, but we have a remarkable opportunity which Washington is not, frankly, taking very good care of. Now, the funny thing is, if you look at the politics of all this in Washington, and you start talking about a manufacturing policy for the country, you will hear from the conservatives and the Tea Party and from most Republicans this hue and cry that government should not pick winners and losers. We should not decide that we should pick winners and losers. Well, the reality, of course, is government has to pick winners and losers. The only difficulty is that for the past 15 years, the U.S. government has chosen for banks and oil companies and agribusiness to be winners and for manufacturing to be a loser. They're picking the wrong winners and losers, but they have to pick winners and losers. When you negotiate trade treaties, you have to protect certain sectors of your economy, and you cannot protect all sectors equally vigorously. And the U.S. government has chosen not to protect the manufacturing sector. Same thing is true of corporate taxes. If you look at who actually pays high U.S. corporate taxes, it's manufacturing companies. It's not banks. They don't pay very high taxes at all because they can offshore their profits much more easily than somebody who's making aluminum in Freeport, Texas can. And finally, the irony is that if you listen to Republican senators in Washington, they are opposed to manufacturing policy. If you listen to Republican governors, and sometimes the same people, they're wildly in favor of it. If you listen to Republican governors like Haley Barbour or even Rick Perry in Texas, when they talk about their economic policies, they mainly talk about their manufacturing policy. It's fine for Texas to have manufacturing policy, but for some reason it's not all right for the United States to. So I think there is a huge gap between Washington and the rest of the country on this topic. There is a huge opportunity, in part because of American ingenuity in creating new clean energy technologies like wind and solar, and in part because of American ingenuity in finding better ways to produce natural gas. We are at a moment when the energy sector could lead the U.S. into a manufacturing renaissance, and Washington and the ideology of the combination of the ideology of free trade and the ideology of the Tea Party is threatening that revival in some very, very scary ways.
Yeah, thank you, Carl. Before we go on, Scott, can you tell us where to find book info online and how people on the call can get it?
Dave, I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to suggest that if people want to learn a little bit more about it, they can go to the website, which is remakingamericabook.com. That's all one word, remakingamericabook.com. And you can see excerpts, some of the reviews, get a hard copy of it. But for folks who are on this call, assuming that you've left us with your contact information, we'll get you a coupon code for a free e-book via Amazon, and would be honored to do that. But those are the easiest ways to do it. And if you have to be talking about it on Twitter, we do have a hashtag, which is hashtag remakebook.
For people not on the call, this is a time when I do a reminder to the call, but now it's a good time for everybody. If you want to get on the list that we have announcing calls like this, remember to contact me at djohnson@ourfuture.com. to be on the list, and we have low volume. It's not one of those annoying lists where you get 200 emails a day. All we do is announcements on important manufacturing things and announcing these calls. So we're going to open up to questions, and if the call moderator could explain how to ask a question, and then I've got a couple questions before that while we wait for questions to queue up.
Yes, thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, press star 1.
Okay, but because I'm running the call, I get to ask the first question. So, Carl, in the book, I noticed you mentioned the NUMMI, NUMMI factory in Fremont, and I just want to say now that factory makes a car called a Tesla. And I live in Menlo Park where Tesla is based, so I just had to mention that. I see 4 or 5 Teslas every time I drive around it. Beautiful car. Expensive. One revival attempt, though, speaking of electric cars, was to bring advanced battery manufacturing to Detroit. Now, I understand China just recently bought the assets of an advanced battery manufacturing company we helped called A123. Should our government have done more to keep companies like A123 from going under. I mean, here we are. We finance this now, trying to get to the technology. What should the government have done, Carl?
Well, first, it's important to say it's not just A123. There's another company, which was called Boston Power, which was based in Boston and was doing a very innovative battery technology. And that company moved to Shanghai. So I guess it's now Shanghai Power. And the reason they moved was quite simple, and it's really the reason A123 moved. It's not that the government didn't do enough to help them make batteries. It's that the U.S. didn't create the markets. They moved to China because that's where the markets for the batteries were. They didn't move to China because it was easier to make them there. They moved them because it was easier to sell them there. And the core problem in the energy sector is the failure to understand that if you really want to encourage energy manufacturing, you need to encourage market access for new energy technologies. You can't let the incumbent energy companies keep new technologies out of the marketplace and expect to make those new technologies here in the United States. Another example, wind turbines. There was a period of time when we actually were making wind turbine blades in North Dakota, Grand Forks, North Dakota, shipping them out of the port of Duluth and shipping them to Brazil. But the reason the factory was originally built in Grand Forks was because at that point there was a very robust U.S. market for wind turbines. And when Congress spent a year debating whether or not it would maintain the same tax treatment for wind turbines that it's previously given to technologies like coal and natural gas, and spent a year debating what to do, the market dried up, and as a result of the market drying up, that wind turbine factory shut down and is no longer exporting wind turbine blades to North Dakota. We are now importing turbine blades because turbine wind power construction has picked up again. But the failure to provide consistent market access for new energy technologies is a very serious threat to the ability of companies like A123 to survive in the United States.
All right, Scott, I'm going to throw you a softball question. The president has promised to create 1 million manufacturing jobs and double exports. How are those going, and what needs to be done?
It's a good question, Dave. It is a bit of a softball. Thank you. We track the president's progress every month on our website through something called the AAMeter. Which we update every time the BL employment statistics are updated, and calculate how many jobs per month need to be created to have a chance of meeting that goal. And the answer is we're far, far behind. We've created about a month's worth of manufacturing jobs necessary to reach that 1 million job manufacturing goal by 2017 in over the course of 7 months. So we're way, way, way behind schedule. In terms of doubling exports, we're also behind schedule for that. And if you, like I do, think that that is half a metric rather than a whole metric, and you have to look at the exports and the imports, we have a stubbornly high trade deficit in goods that has not shrunk at all. It's not growing as fast as it used to be, but it certainly hasn't shrunk at all, and it's still a major problem with regard to China. I'll quickly note that just even with this week, even within this week, in the kind of the consumer community, a guy who does very creative ads and who has helped form something called the Made Collection, which is some kind of like artisan and very interesting modern product, has kind of launched his own campaign to try to do a self-help campaign to create 1 million jobs through consumer demand. So it's not an unreasonable goal to do this. I think that we need policy levers to make it. I do think the president talks about this with some frequency. But concrete action steps beyond the kind of welcome news of having innovation institutes have been slow to come. Even there are some things that the administration could be doing, even without this Congress, to try to prod manufacturing policy forward, but they have not fully embraced a lot of that yet. So I would say we're behind schedule at this point.
Right. If you double exports and triple imports, you're in worse shape than when you started, right?
Okay, yeah, the old saying, one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah. So do we have questions?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 1.
Well, we don't have any questions queued up, it sounds like. So I'll give out a reminder that to get on this list, we do these calls regularly, manufacturing, trade, and related issues. Contact me at djohnson@ourfuture.org to be on the announcement list. So, Carl and Scott, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on this call. I think we're giving a lot of people some good information and helping move this along. So, with that, once again, no more questions?
No, sir. There are no more questions.
All right. Then I'd like to thank everybody for being on the call, and we will talk to you at the next call. Thank you very much.
Carl, thanks, everybody. Thanks for organizing it. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.